Welcome to Soft Tissue Sarcoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Brian Van Tine from Washington University Medical School in St. Louis, and to begin, I asked him to comment on the biology and classification of sarcomas.
I think the first thing that the general medical oncologist has to realize is that the parallel word to sarcoma is actually carcinoma, not, say, breast cancer or lung cancer. Sarcomas represent a group of up to 100 different diseases, depending on how you count them, some benign, some heavily aggressively malignant, that all have different biology, have underlying different genetics, and actually are just frankly very different diseases with different approaches. And so as you kind of get down to the next level of what do they have in common, the actually only thing they have in common is their mesenchymal origin. And so it's everything that arises from something that holds you together, so bones, cartilage, fat, muscle, etc. You know, there's about 15,000 cases. They guess that this is about 1% of the incidence. We still suffer from the lack of an ICD-9 or 10 code. And so a lot of the sarcoma practitioners, there's about 40 of them in the U.S., medical oncologists that solely focus on sarcoma, feel this number is probably an underestimate based on just adding the incidence of all the diseases together. You know, as a whole, you wouldn't take prostate cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, give them, a single agent and expect to see a lot of activity. But this is what we've traditionally done in sarcoma with things like doxorubicin and then seen really low response rates. And then wondered why, you know, we've had a bad time actually finding agents that actually work across the spectrum of different diseases. But individually, when you take things like synovial sarcoma, for example, you find that they're highly sensitive to a lot of different chemotherapies and they're responsive to many things. Whereas if you get to something like a well-differentiated liposarcoma, you find that giving those chemo in the first place is probably not ever warranted. And so, especially with the introduction of pazopanib and then trabectedin and arubulin, these are now coming in where they're getting histology focuses, and the guidelines are actually split up along a lot of different histologies in the NCCN guidelines on purpose, because different agents are shown to have different activity in different diseases. And so I think the statement in the NCCN guidelines about sarcoma is important. And these words are carefully chosen. You know, the guidance for the treatment of sarcoma should come from a multidisciplinary group with an extensive experience in sarcoma. They didn't say treat. And I think that's really important. I think that bringing the right agents to the right sarcoma in the right order is not the 1970s anymore, where everything got doxorubicin and we were done. Now there's this cascade where, you know, an epithelioid sarcoma is probably the cascade of things you do by line is very different than, say, a leiomyosarcoma. And so as we get into this, histology matters and experience matters, because this is a large group of diseases where if you see it all the time, you really do treat it a little bit differently than if you're looking it up. And this is why I think the partnership that really needs to be formed between the general oncologist and the sarcoma centers is a very important relationship that I work very hard in the Midwest to foster.
You know, we've been talking a lot about molecular oncology in general, of course. You know, now you have pathologists who call themselves molecular pathologists and know a lot about the biology of the disease. What do we know about the molecular biology of sarcomas and soft tissue sarcomas? And are we still pretty much stuck in histology-driven classification? Or is there anything to begin to look at, you know, genomics or other ways to classify these diseases?
So I think that that's a complicated question, and so let's start from the top down. I think that we've known for a very long time that you can break soft tissue sarcomas into two groups. One is translocation-driven, which is clearly a genetic signature where two proteins come together that shouldn't be, and the other have complex cytogenetics. And so as you get into it, there is a small group of things like GIST, which have known point mutations that are druggable drivers, which is, you know, almost its own field because it has very clear guidelines for how to treat that. And then you have the molecular drivers of hybrid transcription factors like in synovial sarcoma. And then you end up with things with leiomyosarcoma, which have genetics reminiscent of things like triple-negative breast cancer, where when you go and sequence it, you don't find very much that you can therapeutically, actionably target. And so you kind of run this huge gambit amongst the diseases. Occasionally you find something that falls out. But I mean, in terms of molecular oncology, we use that more, I think it's coming along in soft tissue sarcoma. I think a lot of that comes towards making sure diagnosis is correct, because diagnosis matters. But I think also you have to realize that I think this is one of the more understudied areas of cancer. And because of that, I think there's a lot more to do. I think within that question, though, is the most important thing, which is that pathology really does matter, because when a sarcoma pathologist looks at a sarcoma, about 25%, give or take, depending on the study, of the time they change the diagnosis. And up to 10% of the time, it actually matters. One of the more common things that sarcomas are miscalled as are amelanotic melanomas. And I think in 2016, you probably, if you have a metastatic disease, want melanoma because of immunotherapy.
So just to pick up on that point about pathology, because that's kind of concerning. So if you're a general oncologist in community-based practice, you have a patient with a metastatic soft tissue sarcoma, in what situation should you be thinking about getting a second pathology opinion? Do you do it on everybody?
In my opinion, I say yes. And I think the reference labs such as the Cleveland Clinic and Mayo do a very good job. I think that Fletcher at Harvard does a very good job. I think Alex Lazar down in MD Anderson does a very good job. And these work as good reference labs. But if you're going to actually treat a sarcoma patient right, you should partner with a sarcoma center where you've built trust. And within that second opinion that patient gets, there comes that pathology review that I think is actually one of the most important things that can happen.
Just out of curiosity, in general, do many of these centers offer second opinions without the patient having to come there, where they might review the case and the pathology?
I think that that doesn't happen very often. I think there are places that will do a pathology review.
Right.
Which is common, but I think part of building the correct plan is also having sarcoma surgeons, sarcoma radiation oncologists, and sarcoma medical oncologists look at that specific subtype of sarcoma in that specific patient and build the right plan.
So let's say for your medical oncology fellows who have a systemic treatment bent in the way they're going to look at this, although of course there are interdisciplinary considerations, how do you sort of explain to them your broad concept of the classification of sarcomas, specifically soft tissue sarcomas?
So we actually spend an extensive time, because we have one of the larger centers at WashU, training the fellows about sarcoma. They get multiple lectures from me. And in that, we start breaking down things that you need to learn to recognize and the different lineages. So, you know, there's an entire world of bone tumors that I think both benign and malignant that medical oncologists should know about. And I realize this is a soft tissue sarcoma lecture, but taken together, it's a spectrum of diseases, and the rules for bone sarcomas in terms of second opinions are no different than soft tissue. And as you get into soft tissue, you realize that, you know, fat tumors, intrinsically there's five different kinds just by name. And each one of those has multiple subtypes once you get into the molecular diagnoses. And so as you kind of approach fat tumors, you shouldn't intrinsically think of those as the same way as, say, a smooth muscle tumor or an angiosarcoma, which is just a vascular tumor that very commonly arises secondary to radiation. And these are things we try to drive home. I mean, I think one of the things that the sarcoma doctors unfortunately often see patients too late are in breast cancer patients that develop a rash. And it's a rash that doesn't heal, say, 10 years after they've had radiation for their breast cancer. And most commonly, this is an angiosarcoma. And they grow actually extensively and very quickly and very rapidly. And the longer you take to get that diagnosis, the more frequently the patient's outcome is just diminished. And I think this is something we try to reinforce over and over in the minds of our fellows, is that angiosarcoma is a late gift from radiation that you must always be observant of.
Just to pick up on that, it kind of sounds from what you're saying that maybe in there are cases where the diagnosis is delayed. And for what reason? Is it thought to be local recurrence of the breast cancer or something else? Why do they not get diagnosed?
Well, so 10 years out when people go in, angiosarcoma is such a rare disease. You know, there's about 600 cases a year. I see about two a month. And because of that, you know, we're on the receiving end. We see it. We know what it looks like. It gets diagnosed very quickly. But, you know, a lot of these patients end up with the new push towards their primary care doctors who have no idea what it is. And because of that, I think that this is an educational activity that we need to work on.
So again, is there a way, when you think about the busy oncologists who are trying to figure out first-line therapy, lung cancer nowadays, and a lot of other new things, can you kind of go through some of the major types of soft tissue sarcomas, and particularly the implications in terms of systemic therapy, which I think is something that oncologists are particularly oriented around?
Well, I think this is a very timely conversation, given that olaratumab was just approved, and I think a lot of standards of care have actually just changed for now. Not to divert too quickly, but olaratumab is a monoclonal antibody to the platelet-derived growth factor receptor alpha. Just published in Lancet was the randomized phase 2 of doxorubicin with olaratumab versus doxorubicin followed by olaratumab. And what they found in that trial was a year overall survival in patients that got the combination. And because of that, it was granted contingent FDA approval. The phase 3 is accrued and it's waiting to be read out the next couple of years. And until that happens, I think what we found is we have a new agent that's really altered metastatic frontline therapy.
And I want to go through that. Actually, certainly it's a huge thing that's just happened in the field. But again, can you kind of paint the picture of how you look at sarcomas? So newly approved drugs is something that happens, seems like, all the time now in oncology. So this is just approved. It's a great way to get started. I'm sure oncologists are going to be very interested in this. But again, kind of what's the overall construct of how you see soft tissue sarcomas?
So I think the first question you have to ask when looking at a patient is what their stage is. And the approach to a stage 3 and a stage 4 patient is very different. A stage 3 or 2 patient is a high-grade sarcoma that needs aggressive management. A stage 1 tumor, usually more surgical tumor. So I think this is a conversation more for medical oncologists. Let's focus on stage 2 and 3. In stage 2 and 3, the first question after stage is diagnosis. Things like synovial sarcoma, you're more than likely to start off with a neoadjuvant approach, depending on what center you're at. This is where this gets complicated very quickly. And give them doxorubicin with ifosfamide as a neoadjuvant strategy, followed by then either radiation or surgery, and surgery or radiation. And that would be the approach to a stage of 2 or 3 synovial sarcoma. If you move on to a retroperitoneal sarcoma, you may just elect for surgery. And then the radiation question gets very difficult very quickly. This is why this experience with multidisciplinary teams planning these out correctly and margin status is so important. You know, as you move on to stage 4, you begin then to ask, what sort of stage 4 are they? Is this a patient with extensive metastatic disease, such that the likelihood of cure isn't on the table? You know, they have thousands of lung mets or a bunch of cannonballs. And, you know, how would you approach that patient? Or is this a patient with an isolated lung met or two in the same lobe? And I think these patients are actually approached very differently. In November of 2016, with the addition of this new drug, this becomes a much more complex conversation. Because if you're going to go for response, you're probably still going to trend towards doxorubicin with ifosfamide. If you're going to palliate, you're now going to probably use doxorubicin with olaratumab. And that's why I say this is a great timely conversation, because that is a conversation that's going on within the field, and this is what's going on right now, which is you can give somebody a longer overall survival with a less toxic regimen if you're not trying to cure them. Whereas if you are going to take that patient for cure, you're probably going to still go with an ifosfamide-based regimen because the response rate's higher. And so really it's intent at this point.
So I want to kind of get into that, but again, for example, when you look at those choices that you just talked about, assuming it's, you know, stage 4 metastatic disease, do you pretty much look at all non-GIST soft tissue sarcomas the same way, or do you kind of look at them differently in terms of responsiveness to systemic therapies?
Oh, that's a wonderfully loaded question. So no, histology matters. And so if you're going to be aggressive with a metastatic dedifferentiated leiomyosarcoma, differentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, or any of the more common sarcomas, you would go in one direction. You know, if it pops up as an alveolar soft part sarcoma, you don't give those chemo. You know, epithelioid sarcomas, you're probably not going to use that same set of cytotoxic agents, depending on how they're actually presenting. And so this is much more complicated than any easy discussion of what to use. And so, no, it's not a one-size-fits-all. This isn't, you know, the era of MAID, which has kind of gone away, or doxorubicin, ifosfamide goes to everything anymore. I think this is a much more intricate discussion of what it is and where it is.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what trabectedin is and where it fits in the whole spectrum of treatment.
So trabectedin was isolated in the 1960s at NIH, and it's been a drug that went through some complications with the FDA after its original trial and got worldwide approval, and it's been used for about a decade everywhere but here. And so there's extensive data. And so because of what happened with the original trial in the FDA, the bar was set pretty high for this phase 3 clinical trial for what needed to happen, which was an overall survival benefit. What was done at the time was they chose the two most sensitive histologies, which were high-grade liposarcomas and leiomyosarcomas, for this minor DNA groove binder. You know, doxorubicin binds to the major groove, this binds to the minor groove. What it actually does beyond that, I think it does a lot of things. We don't understand the drug as well as we should. But, you know, given us a 24-hour infusion, it's actually well tolerated.
Could I just clarify, in terms of the mechanism, could you draw the analogy again of where doxorubicin works and where trabectedin works?
So in the DNA, as it twists, you've got both the major groove, which doxorubicin likes to bind into, and the minor groove, where this drug binds. And we've done trials looking to see if using them together is better, and it doesn't seem to be. But it's a well-tolerated drug given as a slow infusion. And this is going to get more complicated because there's an ovarian trial coming out of trabectedin soon. And the timing for sarcoma patients and the timing for ovarian patients is very different. Sarcoma patients are going to have to get this drug over 24 hours. We've done a trial of 3 hours versus 24, and 24 was superior, whereas ovarian patients are just going to get this over 3 hours. But this is something where you can send patients home on a pump, and they come back the next day, get detached, get their own body and elastin, and go home. And so this is a drug that you do have to know how to use.
What specific tolerability and toxicity issues have been observed with the drug?
So I think the first thing that you have to worry about with trabectedin are liver function issues. And so you can get a lot of AST, ALT elevations, which I think have to be carefully monitored for and carefully adjusted dose-wise. I think just like any cytotoxic agent, you expect neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, anemia. These all have to be treated appropriately. There's a couple other side effects of this, which I think are important and that don't always come out. I think the first is that this drug can cause rhabdomyolysis. And so checking CKs is incredibly important on these patients because you don't want to miss that. And then there's a very complicated issue of heart failure, and whether or not it's actually caused by the trabectedin or if it's caused by prior exposure in this trial to the doxorubicin. Because we know, say, in the trial there was a 3% rate of dacarbazine causing heart failure, which it doesn't cause, but there was a 6% heart failure in the trabectedin arm. And so then there becomes this question of, does this actually add to it? And I think the recommended is that you continue getting echoes just to make sure that you're not inducing heart failure and any signs you would stop.
Do you have any concerns about giving trabectedin in patients with a history of heart failure?
I think that's complicated, and I think that there's so many agents that you'd have to have a good reason.
So, you know, I know in the phase 3 trial, they did see with trabectedin a progression-free survival of 4.2 months versus 1.5 for dacarbazine, hazard rate of 0.55. What do you think about that?
So I think that is the analysis that actually got the final approval for the patients that actually were treated in trial. First off, you have to realize that dacarbazine is not either a placebo or an inactive drug. And in fact, there's unusual activity of dacarbazine in, say, uterine leiomyosarcoma, which is included in the trial. And so there are some patients with uterine leiomyosarcoma where this drug is a very good match. There's some people that were on that for almost a year. And that's actually really good in soft tissue sarcoma. But difference shows that we have a very active agent. And so because of that, even though when you go to the overall survival, it's a very complicated discussion to get into. And so what you have to realize is that most of the enrollments for this trial were third line at sarcoma centers. And so you've had doxorubicin and ifosfamide, and then potentially a second line agent. And then you go on to a randomization of either dacarbazine or trabectedin. And I think what you're seeing there is a potential selection for patients overall that are going to do a little bit better because they can get to a sarcoma center for third line therapy.
The bottom line is they didn't see a benefit in terms of survival. The hazard ratio was 0.87, but it wasn't statistically significant. But the other thing was they picked out Leiomyosarcoma sarcoma and liposarcoma. I guess those were the two histology allowed into the trial. It looks like they both had a benefit.
Yeah, so in the overall and final analysis of PFS, it trended towards trabectedin being more active than dacarbazine. And I think given the worldwide data that's available on the drug, the FDA not only looked at this trial, which was at least positive for PFS, but the worldwide experience and allowed FDA approval of trabectedin.
So what about using trabectedin in sarcomas other than leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma?
So if you look at the NCCN guidelines, it's actually for soft tissue sarcoma. And it wasn't really pigeonholed because if you look at how this drug is used, it is actually a good sarcoma drug. It's basically a DNA minor groove binder that with a lot of activity. Especially so you can now reference the nice papers the French have put out by histology and where it seems to be more and less active. There is a utility of this drug beyond just where this trial was done because this trial was limited because the bar was set so high initially.
Let me throw a few trabectedin questions. You mentioned rhabdomyolysis and 62-year-old man, metastatic liposarcoma, that receives trabectedin at 1.5 milligram per meter squared, 24-hour infusion. Every 3 weeks, responding well. Post cycle 8, he develops rhabdomyolysis with markedly elevated creatinine phosphokinase and acute renal failure. Patient's managed with vigorous hydration, other supportive care, recovers completely. Patient wants to continue therapy because he's tolerating it well, responding well. Would you resume the trabectedin?
I actually think not. I think that might hit a safety threshold in my personal practice.
And this doc wants to know, what's the basis for the rhabdomyolysis and how often do you see it?
I've seen it twice, but I use this drug extensively. The basis for it's a little bit unknown. It's just one of those things that came out that's been seen clearly with this drug that must always be looked for.
Any risk factors that put a patient at particular risk for this problem?
No, because the patients where I found it happening clearly were some of the more healthy patients I had at the time, and so there's no known risk factor because it's a less than 1% risk.
So I'm going to be curious to see how you utilize eribulin in your practice. And we've talked about eribulin mainly in our breast cancer programs where it's used for metastatic disease, HER2-negative disease. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about eribulin in sarcomas?
I think that this is a wonderful discussion that I like to have about how histology matters. And so when you get into the trabectedin trial, you find that there is subset analysis that shows activity of trabectedin amongst many, many, many different histologies, especially when you get into the extended data. The interesting thing about the trabectedin trial is that it was positive for progression-free survival and not overall survival. Eribulin is a lesson that histology really does matter because there was a positive overall survival in the eribulin phase 3 trial, but not a progression-free survival. And it turns out that the positivity in the eribulin trial is driven almost exclusively by the liposarcoma patients in the trial, but they only represent a third of a trial. And so what you find is this is probably a drug that's best used only for liposarcomas that are high grade, as the activity in leiomyosarcoma is really no better than, or potentially even not as good as dacarbazine. And so this is why, you know, one of the things that I go back to is one of the first things we talked about is the parallel word to sarcoma is carcinoma, and leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma are completely different diseases. And, one subset of liposarcomas are driven by MDM2 amplifications, where a lot of leiomyosarcomas have a P53 mutation. And so there's different kinds of breast cancer and how they should be approached, but we put them all into trials together. And so as you get into the data, what you find is that arubulin is a good liposarcoma drug. It, you should probably be focused there.
What about regorafenib? We've heard a lot about regorafenib. We talk about it a lot in our colon cancer programs, but I saw there was a presentation on regorafenib in sarcomas at ASCO. What do we know about it?
So it's interesting that, when you start talking about tyrosine kinase inhibitors, including, we have an FDA approval for pazopanib. 2 years ago, a group I was involved in recently published a paper on tivozanib as active, and now regorafenib. A lot of these are just dirty tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The regorafenib trial took all soft tissue sarcomas that were high grade, then allowed them on trial and found that regorafenib seems to have a signal of activity. I think that this is something that I wouldn't jump to using yet. I think it's something where a lot of clinical trials need to be finished or further exploited so that we know where that drug may fit in soft tissue sarcoma. Because, as you get into that data, you begin wondering what sort of signal you're actually looking at in the subset analysis. And so what we're hitting, I think a lot of the targets in sarcoma in terms of their tyrosine kinases are really unknown. My hypothesis is really that the reason we're finding a lot of these dirty drugs have activity is you're hitting different things in different sarcomas and at least seeing activity.
So I see actually this trial, REGO-SARC, was published in Lancet Oncology. I don't know if it's the same data set that was presented at ASCO, but their conclusion is that it has, quote, an important clinical anti-tumor effect. This is a single agent, right?
Yeah.
In non-adipocytic soft tissue sarcomas, improving progression-free survival. Do you think that's true?
I think that that is probably true. I think that where we're going to put that drug needs a lot more work, to be honest. And I wouldn't want general practitioners just randomly writing it.
Interesting. What did they see in terms of tolerability? It's such an issue with colon cancer. Did they use the same dosing?
I think in our experience, because, the GIST patients have come off sunitinib, they like regorafenib, and our patients have come off chemo, that these seem to be better tolerated in our patient population because I think it's perspective.
That's interesting. As long as you brought it up, what about pazopanib? We got a couple questions about that. What's the role in your own practice outside of trial setting nowadays in terms of pazopanib?
I think pazopanib is a really useful drug. I think it's got some dosing complications in the soft tissue sarcoma realm that I think are soon to be addressed with new trials. I think it causes diarrhea, I think it causes fatigue, and I think that there's a hepatotoxicity that has a black box warning, but beyond that, if you can get the dosing right, I personally use a dose escalation that's not on label to get the tolerability in my patients to where it needs to be. I think it's a good drug, and there is a subset of patients where that is a really good drug. I've had some people, some patients with, I know it's not a soft tissue sarcoma, but say myxoid chondrosarcoma, they seem to go on that for years. I've had some synovial patients which go on it for just unbelievable amounts of time. And I know these are all extreme responders, but it is a really good drug for the right patient.
So you mentioned sarcomas entered the novel agent world, monoclonal antibody to PDGFR. Sounds kind of cool, different than chemo at least. Olaratumab, what exactly is it? And what do we know about it in terms of clinical research findings?
So it's kind of a fascinating drug. It was a trial that started many, many years ago, actually when I was a fellow. It was actually at the original investigators meeting. And, WashU put the first patient on this drug because we actually managed to accidentally get open before Memorial, which was leading the trial. And so I've worked with this drug for about, 5-6 years. It's really incredibly tolerated. And with the caveat that if you live in the Midwest, you have to watch out for anaphylactic reactions.
Whoa.
Because of all the aspergillus.
Hold on. I haven't heard that one. Can you go back through that? It's a monoclonal antibody, right? I mean, a geographic belt, it kind of sounds a little cetuximab-like.
It is exactly cetuximab-like. And so we actually heavily premedicate our patients. Most of the reinfusion reactions on the trial are mine. But it just has to do with, we have antibody reactions, it's common. And so as long as you know your antibody potentiation for reaction, it's a great drug.
But again, the cetuximab thing was some kind of external antigen in the environment or something. Is this the same antigen?
It seems to be.
Wow.
We're not really sure, but we have the same reactions.
And St. Louis is in that. Are you in the cetuximab belt also?
I believe the rumor was we were one of the sites audited when the cetuximab reactions were happening.
Because I know like the middle states and North Carolina and all, where roughly is the belt?
Gosh, I think it's Missouri, Illinois, Arkansas. It's kind of this Aspergillus north-south, kind of middle of the country.
So, with cetuximab, you have panitumumab. What do you do in terms of olaratumab?
You give steroids.
Wow, interesting. So in your area then, what fraction of people have, reactions?
It's less than 10%, but I think it's just something you have to be cognizant of.
Interesting. Okay, so you have the infusion reaction more in certain geographic areas. Anything else? Any cytopenias?
The data showed that there was a little bit higher rate of cytopenias. I think it may have been because the patient stayed on doxorubicin longer, and so it's really hard to pull apart what the olaratumab does from just doxorubicin exposure.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the trial looked at and what they saw there?
So the trial was a randomized phase 2 with about 66 patients in each arm. Doxorubicin given for 8 cycles with olaratumab given every cycle, followed by olaratumab maintenance versus doxorubicin alone, and at the time of failure, olaratumab as a monoagent. And what was seen in the overall survival was just under a year overall survival in patients that got the combination, but not the patients that got it sequentially.
And of course, the thing that was also seen that was a little perplexing, and it's been seen with a number of agents in different kinds of tumors, was that the progression-free survival advantage was much less impressive.
So there was just under a 2-month difference that was not statistically significant. But then I think there's a lot of work going on to kind of begin to explain the mechanism. And what's being hinted at is maybe we're altering the ability of sarcoma to spread by altering the microenvironment. And so the reason people may live longer is they may not be as fit to metastasize.
That's interesting. The paper was published this summer. The editorial that was written, which was written by Dr. Van de Graaff from the UK, kind of concludes that this is promising, and they look forward to the announced trial, which I guess is the phase 3 study. It doesn't talk anything about the idea of actually using it based on these data, and then boom, the FDA approved it.
Yeah, I think the FDA approved it contingently based on a year overall survival. Because I think one of the things that has perplexed all the investigators is our ability to explain a year overall survival in a small randomized phase 2, because it was randomized. And I think we've analyzed this trial every which way to Sunday and can't come up with a really good reason for why one arm did really dramatically a year better. A year better is the first time we've, the overall survival seen both arubulin is what, maybe 8-10 months in the liposarcoma population, but only in liposarcoma. This was a mixed histology trial.
And I'm sure it's influenced by the lack of other great alternatives that, medical necessity, et cetera. It was interesting that they actually did approve it. So now that it is approved, and the other thing was kind of, I thought a little bit weird, was it's in people who you're thinking about doxorubicin. So I'm trying to figure out, who don't you think about doxorubicin with a metastatic sarcoma?
Well, so there's a whole list of subtypes that you wouldn't give chemo to. So that's really one, what that's actually referring
to.
Yeah. And two, you still get back to the discussion we started having earlier about who actually should probably still get ifosfamide.
So just to backtrack, though, what subtypes of sarcoma would you say, generally speaking, should not get chemo and therefore not get this drug?
It might be easier to go at and approach this from what the common person would probably see, which would be the things that were included in the trial. So you would be more the undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcomas. If you have an out-of-date pathologist, it would have been called malignant fibrous histiocytoma.
Oh, I remember that one from med school.
Yeah, we've changed the name.
Wow.
This is how you know whether or not your pathologist is good.
Wow.
synovial sarcoma, leiomyosarcoma, dedifferentiated liposarcoma, pleomorphic liposarcoma. This is, in that list, probably 50-60% of all soft tissue sarcomas. That kind of gives you the go-ahead for using this drug. Beyond that, if you start getting things you haven't heard of, I think that this partnership really of, you know, do you go to a sarcoma center before starting treatment? I mean, I think the answer 9 times out of 10, it should be yes.
See, I think, you know, maybe, okay, great, it's if you can go to a center, but, you know, a lot of people can't or don't want to go to a center. But, you know, if there's a way to sort of run the case by a center, you know, just the pathology and what you think you're going to do.
I think every region of the country works a little differently. Actually, I do quite a lot of that with the Midwest doctors. And so a lot of the times, you know, they call me, we get it reviewed, and they start something if there's not a trial. But I mean, this is a patient population that actually gets up and travels. And the reason for that is these are the zebra cases, and no patient likes to be, I've never seen one of these before. No patient likes to be that patient. And this is when they come to a sarcoma center, they tell me they have this ultra-rare leiomyosarcoma, and I roll my eyes. It's actually, you know, comforting for me to say that you're about 25% of what I've seen today. And they sat in the waiting room where there were lots and lots of people. And there's some comfort in seeing that their plan's being put together by people who see their disease all the time. You know, the Sarcoma Alliance actually, you know, you can work with Angel Flights and Sarcoma Alliance to get to places where people have extensive experience. There's very few, other than, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Montana, Wyoming, outside of these states, most sarcoma centers are within a couple hundred miles.
And what situations do you think you would use olaratumab? I mean, I guess the other option would be doxorubicin ifosfamide, right?
Or just doxorubicin.
Doxorubicin alone. Yeah, okay. So how do you sort of sort that out?
I think this gets a little bit easier. Given the tolerability of olaratumab, giving single-agent doxorubicin by itself to me now doesn't make a lot of sense. And so at least as a treating sarcoma doctor, I think it now just becomes a question of doxorubicin ifosfamide versus doxorubicin olaratumab. And so it's AI versus AO. And so if you look at the patients, I think the first question is, do you need a response? And do you need a response now, or are you trying to cure the patient? I think this is a very, very small subset of patients where at least I personally will be picking up ifosfamide. I think for the standard metastatic non-curable case, doxorubicin with olaratumab is going to be my personal standard of care. I think it's going to be a little reflective of what center you're at and how dedicated that center is to ifosfamide in the first place. Because a lot of centers are saying this wasn't compared to doxorubicin ifosfamide. It was just compared to doxorubicin, but that was a lot of centers' standards of care given how difficult ifosfamide is.
We were talking about olaratumab, and I see that you have a 57-year-old man with a leiomyosarcoma who actually got it on a clinical trial with doxorubicin. What happened with this patient?
So I may be one of those people that has a tendency, at least for the cases, to pick out extreme responders. But this patient was a patient that actually did rather well on the trials. So he went through his 8 cycles of doxorubicin with olaratumab, actually tolerated it well, needed some blood transfusion support.
What was his clinical status when he started in his history? Where was the disease? Was he symptomatic from it?
So this was a 57-year-old white male who had originally a retroperitoneal leiomyosarcoma that was resected. Then he appeared with lung nodules to my clinic. At that point, he had multiple lung nodules, approximately 25, and both lungs. So I didn't feel that, given his age and his performance status, even though he was a good 57, I didn't think doxorubicin with ifosfamide was going to prolong him in a way or cure him. So therefore, we enrolled him on a clinical trial at the time, which was the original phase 1/2 of olaratumab. And so in this, he got 8 cycles of doxorubicin along with olaratumab.
Any infusion problems that you were talking about? Anything with him?
Not with that one.
Okay.
Which was good. And then went on olaratumab for maintenance for almost a year before he finally progressed.
When he was on the maintenance, any quality life issues or toxicities?
Well, actually, before this trial came out, I used to say that olaratumab maintenance was the nicest thing I could ever do to a patient because it's a monoclonal antibody. Other than taking up time to give the patient, it's incredibly well tolerated. He then went on, actually later, to the trabectedin trial. And really did notice the difference of being on chemotherapy and wanted olaratumab back and unfortunately it didn't exist.
Well, I would like to hear about the trabectinib too, but just with the olaratumab and the doxorubicins, did he have an objective response?
Actually, he had stable disease.
So he had stable disease. And how long was it from the time you first started the doxorubicin olaratumab and the time he had progression?
About a year.
A year. And, you know, if you globally look at a patient like that, is that roughly what you would expect or a little better than you would expect?
Actually, that was a lot better than I would expect. And the average sarcoma patient from the diagnosis of metastatic disease lives, give or take, a couple of months, 14 months.
Hmm.
And that was frontline therapy.
Have you had any patients on that study who went out 2 or 3 years?
I think we had one patient make it out to 2.
Hmm. So he then had disease progression, again, the progression in the lungs?
Yeah.
And was he symptomatic from it with pulmonary problems?
No.
So he had progression on imaging. He was still feeling okay. And then you said he went on a trabectinib trial?
Well, in between that and the trabectinib trial, he actually went on Gemtax briefly. It didn't work, and then went right on to the trabectinib trial.
And that was trabectinib by itself?
Mm-hmm.
That was the one comparing it to DTIC?
Yeah.
And what happened on the trabectinib with him?
I think he was on that for about 6 months.
Again, any tolerability toxicity issues?
No, he actually did rather well, other than a little bit of fatigue.
And any response?
So I think response is a conversation we probably should have had earlier. Response in sarcoma is actually related to the histology you're looking at.
Hmm.
So one of the things that I think it's important for general medical oncologists to remember is that sarcomas come from that lineage of tumors that hold you together. So a lot of times when we kill them, they fibrose.
Hmm.
And so stable disease is not necessarily viable disease. And so we have a hard time, until you get to some of the things I've seen with immunotherapy, really getting objective response rates in a lot of patients. Whereas stable disease, which is prolonged, is actually a lot of the time a good thing. And I think we learned that in the molecular age, where we started biopsying the thing that was easy to go at and would find it was dead and fibrotic.
So he had stable disease?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that he preferred the olaratumab, I guess from a quality of life point of view, compared to the trabectinib, because of what? The fatigue?
The fatigue, getting chemo hits you, whereas a monoclonal antibody, incredibly well tolerated.
Do you see alopecia with the trabectinib?
Rarely.
And beyond fatigue, was there more in terms of how it affects? Again, I'm trying to figure out why this man didn't like it compared or preferred.
No, it was the fatigue that comes. Well, so if you're used to basically living like a normal person, not getting therapy, which is the equivalent of getting maintenance olaratumab, in my opinion. And then you go back on chemo. That's a radical alteration in your life. It's like going back on chemo. And so he liked the olaratumab because it was really the highest quality of life I've seen, because it was basically a non-toxic treatment for a very long time.
I want to ask you also about your 57-year-old man with a myxoid liposarcoma. What happened there? This is a patient, high-grade round cell component metastatic to the lung that failed doxorubicin and trabectinib, got arubulin.
Yeah, got arubulin. So arubulin actually shrank his tumor a little bit, and he was on that for about 5 months.
So exactly in what situations do you use arubulin, and what do you generally observe?
So I think arubulin is something I use in the myxoid dedifferentiated liposarcomas once I'm done with clinical trial. I'm still at a sarcoma center where we're here to transform the treatment of sarcoma, not just treat patients, because that's what I rely on my general medical oncology partners to do, which is to treat the patients while we try and improve therapy. But we kind of reach for that later line in the liposarcoma patients, because until you start having problems with the neuropathies, it's an active agent there.
And what do you observe in terms of tolerability?
So until the neuropathies pick up, I think it's a pretty well-tolerated drug. I mean, I think the breast cancer literature is pretty, and I'm sure you've talked a lot about arubulin and breast cancer, and so I don't think I would add anything where it's dramatically that different.
Right. And talking about new things, of course, no conversation nowadays in any tumor type is completed until you ask about checkpoint inhibitors. And I see that actually checkpoint inhibitors have been looked at, including work that you've been done that looks pretty interesting. I see this paper here from ASCO. Looks pretty interesting with pembrolizumab, and there are some other papers with other checkpoint inhibitors, nivolumab. What do we know about checkpoint inhibitors and sarcomas?
So I think that's a question that is complicated by the fact that the most important clinical trial, in my opinion, that's going to come out has not yet been reported. I think the Alliance clinical trial of ipilimumab with nivolumab is the trial that we actually need to have the conversation about once it's reported.
That's a randomized study?
It is a randomized trial of ipilimumab, nivolumab versus nivolumab.
So maybe you can backtrack and start with what we know about single agents and then what we know about this combination.
So I think that the SARC-28 trial is a very elegantly done trial. SARC-28 was the soft tissue and bone sarcoma trial of pembrolizumab. It took 40 soft tissue patients and 40 bone patients.
You said it's pembrolizumab, right?
Yeah. Within the 40 soft tissue patients, it took 10 versions of four different subtypes and looked at its efficacy as a mono agent. And undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcomas, there was activity. Leiomyosarcomas, there was activity. Synovial sarcoma, which is translocation driven and not that mutated, there really wasn't. In the bone sarcomas, I think one of the things that jumps out at you is that you see 60 differentiated chondrosarcoma patients, you see activity. And so this is a small trial that really does need to be expanded upon. There's a lot of molecular work, some of which is going to be presented soon, biomarker work that kind of related who responded against biomarkers.
Well, the thing we've seen in a lot of the pembrolizumab studies and checkpoint inhibitors in general, obviously, of course, is PD-L1 levels. I don't see it here in the abstract. You guys didn't report it yet, huh?
I know the answer, and I can't say it, and it's going to be surprising.
Going to be surprising. So I guess that means there's no correlation or whatever. But I don't even understand, you know.
It's just different.
Well, also, you know, okay, we started out with lung and melanoma. That kind of made sense to me. External carcinogen, mutational load. Then we flip over to Hodgkin lymphoma. Okay, Hodgkin, I can maybe understand that, at least in terms of how, you know, what we know about it. But, sarcomas. What's the biology in your mind?
Well, so the biology of sarcoma is so diverse. I mean, you have to realize it's a plethora of diseases. Some of them have a heavy mutational load. Some of them are driven by small amplifications, and some of them are driven by point mutations. And so as you get through it, there are areas in our world which are going to dramatically respond to the correct combination of immunotherapy agents, and then you've got the ones that just aren't, like Ewing's.
So what about the combination? Of course, again, that's now approved in melanoma. It's being looked at in a lot of cancers, including lung cancer, in terms of anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 agent. What do we know about it in sarcomas?
At this point, I'm hoping that this gets presented at ASCO. I'm one of the investigators on the trial.
On the next ASCO?
Yeah, I'm hoping by next ASCO, Sandra D'Angelo will be able to present the data, and I think it's going to be the direction this conversation needs to start going in.
That's interesting. It sounds like you see a potential future, at least in some situations for sarcoma. Do you think it's going to be a biomarker-driven algorithm?
Potentially.
PD-L1? Mutational load or both? Neither?
I prefer not to comment. I don't think it's my data to talk about,
okay.
And so I don't think it's fair. We'll find out.
We can guess. It kind of reminds
me. I think ACR is going to come out, and I think it's going to be interesting. Remember, this is mesenchymal biology, and therefore getting different answers should not necessarily be surprising.
Anyhow, maybe we can finish out. If you want to pick at least one of your local cases, maybe we can start out with your 37-year-old man with a 15-centimeter synovial sarcoma.
So at Washington University in St. Louis, we have actually risk stratified patients. I published a paper based on our experience where we used the Memorial Sloan Kettering nomogram and risk assessed patients for relapse. And what we found is patients that actually scored greater than 30% at 4 years for distant relapse actually seemed to benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy in our hands. And those that didn't. And so it was interesting. Our data set had both patients treated in the community and patients treated within our center. And so we had patients that were low risk that had gotten chemotherapy outside, and then the high-risk patients that didn't get it outside, and then what we had been doing inside, which was risk stratified against a 30%, and had to do with what the relapse nomogram really looks like, which is why we chose 30%. A synovial sarcoma, though, is so chemosensitive that I'll pretty much give neoadjuvant chemotherapy to any synovial sarcoma that walks in the door. That's one of the reasons that I brought that case up. You know, there's two reasons to give neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy. One is to improve the resectability of disease, and the other is to try to kill micrometastatic disease. And this is a very complicated very controversial within the field, can have days-long arguments, and I think they actually have, about who gets what. And I think where this gets really complicated very quickly is that we did a carcinoma version trial when we started looking at adjuvant therapy. So we haven't done a leiomyosarcoma, you know, extremity-only trial looking at adjuvant chemotherapy. We took a whole bunch of different diseases and then came out with kind of messy responses and did a large meta-analysis, which is where the AI comes from. And it's all different doses, all different routes. And so it's a complicated discussion. You know, there are some institutions that won't give it at all. And there are some institutions that give it to everyone. And so because of that, I think this is why you have to work with the sarcoma center that you're comfortable with.
So this patient with the 15 centimeter synovial sarcoma of the extremity, where was it?
So it was in his left lower leg.
If you, based on what you heard about it, because you didn't see him till after surgery, do you think if you'd seen him before surgery, you would have given neoadjuvant treatment?
Yes.
What neoadjuvant treatment would you have given?
Doxorubicin with ifosfamide.
And is that what he got adjuvantly?
Yes.
How did he do?
Great.
Okay, well, let's go on to your next case. But before we do, I have one that was sent in. 54-year-old woman was found to have a 6-centimeter primary uterine leiomyosarcoma penetrating the entire uterine wall. Metastatic workup is negative. Would you recommend adjuvant chemo? If yes, what and for how long?
So I think that most of the standard of care comes from Marty Hensley at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Really, what this is kind of a different tumor with different guidelines, and soon there's a paper about to come out demonstrating clearly different biology. And the recommendations usually are to give about 4 to 8 cycles of gemcitabine with docetaxel. And what you find is that that is a disease where a second controversy also comes up, which is, was that patient morcellated?
Mm.
Because if that patient was openly morcellated, I might actually elect to give doxorubicin with ifosfamide and gemcitabine with docetaxel, because morcellation takes these little fibroids and spins the tumor and puts little pieces of it all throughout the abdomen. And so there's been a big controversy over the past couple of years dealing with morcellation and why this might not be a good thing.
Have you seen patients who had that done?
Yes, many.
And you treat them differently?
Oh, no. If I actually had gotten up at the time of their morcellation and known they were metastatic, yes. Most of the time they show up with their disease all over their abdomen.
Oh, so you're saying you would actually treat at the time of morcellation?
If they were morcellated and the disease was spread all over their abdomen, yes.
Wow, interesting.
And much more aggressively. We don't have standards, but this is why open morcellation within the abdomen is something that really must be discussed as a risk for cancer spread.
So we got a number of cases of people who had Mets resected, wanting to know whether or not to give, quote, pseudo-adjuvant therapy. And I see your 62-year-old woman with a uterine leiomyosarcoma who presented with a single lung met. What happened there?
So, you know, this is a complicated issue, and I chose this patient on purpose. The first is, in general, at my institution, we don't use ifosfamide in patients over 60, given the tolerability decreases and the neurotoxicity increases as you get closer to 70. And because of that, we pretty much have a cutoff of 60 for most patients because of tolerability. She had a single lung nodule that was 2 centimeters that was resected. And because of that, we actually elected to also give her adjuvant doxorubicin and ifosfamide. And she's now 2 years out.
And when you see these patients, first of all, do you generally do a PET scan to rule out other disease?
So PET scanning in most of the sarcomas is complicated. And if you don't have a primary tumor to know if PET scanning in the first place was positive, a negative PET scan is not reassuring. It may just not be picking up disease. So standard imaging doesn't usually involve a PET scan unless you're looking at angiosarcoma or synovial, which just usually pick up signal. And so it's a very complicated topic, which is why it's not like standard practice. Because if you have a primary tumor and it lights up like Christmas and you don't see any mets, it is. But most of the time, by the time somebody gets to a sarcoma center, they're missing their primary tumor.
And in terms of this issue of, quote, pseudo-adjuvant therapy, do you generally utilize it? Or, you know, assuming the patient's, you know, in good enough shape to get treatment? Or do you look at the time from the primary to the met in making that decision?
I think that's a complicated conversation taken patient by patient. And so usually once it's spread to lung, it's going to show up somewhere else. And actually my standard practice now before metastatectomy is actually to give the chemo while the disease is still there. And if I either get a response or don't get anything that shows up for 3 or 4 months, then put them through a metastatectomy. And what we found there is that we're getting these prolonged disease-free intervals. And in fact, we had actually, in some patients where, you know, surgery wasn't a great option, started ablating things, which led to a clinical trial of ablation that we have going on. Because we have patients where we treated them with, you know, 6 cycles of chemotherapy, stabilized their disease, and ablated them. And, you know, they'll go years without any recurrence. And so this has to do with the concept of not playing whack-a-mole with surgery with a patient. Which is, if you have prolonged stable disease, going after the disease makes sense. Whereas if you get too surgically aggressive, by the time they've healed from one surgery, they just have something else to worry about.
So one final question. Getting back to the checkpoint thing, it's kind of been rolling around in my head a little bit. One other thing, you know, of course, we hear about these in like every cancer, you know, you see responses. And the big question is, how long do they last? Have prolonged responses been observed to single agent or combination checkpoint inhibitors?
So far, I have 6 patients treated with a variety of different checkpoint inhibitors that are now all greater than a year with disease-free. And I don't know. And I tell my patients, I don't know. You know, I have some people where they had clearly aggressive metastatic disease and it's gone.
And I'm sure you got plenty of people who didn't have any benefit whatsoever.
Clearly.
But that's really interesting.
But these were the brave group of patients that volunteered for a clinical trial to teach us not to use immunotherapy without some sort of stimulant for Ewing's. You know, this was that brave group of patients that said, experiment on us so we could figure this out. But, you know, out of that, I think, came just an immense amount of knowledge and a lot of hope for a lot of patients.
Do you think a couple of years from now that's going to be an important part of therapy?
I am really hoping, because for what I've seen, I don't know how to explain. It's really cool.